Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is Chris Mascardi. Chris is the marketing director of Epic and New Zero World. We met in Boston at Climatech. We were on stage together, and he is a real leader and visionary, along with his partner in crime, Natalia, on the project. A very grand vision, a very important one, has been treading in this space for quite some time, and it is a space that we are deeply committed to here, Chris, manifested not only with Climatech, but things that we've been doing in this space as well for years, as we as a planet have little choice but to confront the challenges that we have and building a bridge to our industry, which is uniquely positioned to influence the course of events going forward, is not only an opportunity, but, you know, I think we would both agree it's an obligation. So a hearty welcome and really happy to have you here, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I'm happy to be here.
So, Chris, I was not a kid who was a science kid in elementary school or high school or university. I struggled to pass the lab science requirement at Emory University, which was a requirement to graduate. And now I find myself immersed in the scientific world, talking in a deep fashion with folks like yourself, folks who work at places like the Salata Institute at Harvard, at MIT, at The Engine, and other pieces of the MIT ecosystem. I've sort of gotten myself to a point where I know enough to be dangerous, which is probably as far as I'll go. Talk about your passion for the subject, and were you a science kid?
I was not a science kid. Very similar to you, it sounds like. Science always fascinated me. I was attracted to these broad concepts, but the nitty-gritty of it, you know, sitting in that physics lab, I couldn't do the equations, right? So I was immersed in science in some capacity. I never really considered myself a science kid. I was always a writer, a storyteller, an artist in some capacity. I followed that through school, through my time at Emerson. And then coming out of Emerson, you know, I dabbled in a few different things and then landed in advertising because it was a vehicle for storytelling. But again, similar to you, as I got deeper and deeper into this world, it seemed like I was understanding the science behind how it worked, behind the power, the influence that advertising has and has had for millennia over our culture. And that just really grabbed me as a really fascinating subject. And then when you combine that with the planetary science, the sustainable development, the, like you said, the necessity for us to take on this challenge, that this crisis that we've put ourselves in, it was a really natural step for me to put the two together.
I love that. Talk about Emerson, great school. It was not part of our Climatech family. We were focused on the schools that are really immersed in the technology space. But from a comms vantage point, Emerson's a fantastic place.
Oh my goodness, yeah. I mean, you have some of the best storytellers in the country, if not the world, coming out of a school like Emerson. It's where the next generation of storytellers is trained, right? In how best to take important content, sometimes not important content, right? Depending on what genre you want to be working in, but to take content and make it engaging and relatable and enjoyable and thought-provoking, inspiring, all these different emotions that drive the decisions we make every day. Between their theater programs, their journalism program, I came up in the video production program when video production was still pretty nascent, you know? It was newly digital, right? Video production was newly digital. So the film program there was still the sort of heady department that it had been for a long time, and video production felt like the new kid on the block. But the flexibility of it, I wanted to work in documentary filmmaking. And the flexibility of the digital format versus film was just so enticing to me, to be able to quickly capture something, turn it around, tell that story on to the next one. Because there just felt like so many things out there that I wanted to be learning about or talking about or sharing in some way.
Great stuff. So I think we're going to break from format. You know, usually I do a little more of a sort of a walk through your career. You've been in some great companies we know and love, like Tag and Schneider Electric, but there's a lot of ground to cover with you, Chris. And I want to start here now by talking about a book brilliantly titled Still Waiting for My Jetpack, Science Fiction, Futurism, and Marketing All Converging. Talk about the book. It's really a unique juxtaposition of notions, phrases, words, etc. But really, I think gets to the heart of who you are.
It really does. It was a bit of a passion project that also coincided with my MBA, which I got a few years ago from the University of Washington. Again, I just, as I was working in the marketing field and advertising, I was really compelled to understand how the behavioral science behind it worked. Why is this vehicle so powerful in the daily choices that we make? I have been a sci-fi nerd my entire life. It's sort of the bread and butter that I grew up on in terms of storytelling. And it felt very natural for me to try to look at these depictions of the future that we get through science fiction, and then look at what I was doing every day in marketing and in advertising and say, how do we actually use this machine that we have access to get to this place that we want to be? Now, admittedly, a lot of sci-fi is very dystopian, so that's not where we want to be. But you find some of these gems in the literature and in the film and in the comics and stuff like that, that just depict a future that's kind of like, this is a place I want to be living in. This is a future that I want to be a part of. It just felt very natural to be able to put those two disciplines together. And look, I'm not the first one to make these connections by any stretch, right? There, I think lots and lots of people who have studied and written extensively about the power of advertising, and I've cited a lot of them in the book. Futurism is an entire discipline that, you know, futurists work with these corporations to project 10, 20, 50 years out to help them make decisions now. I think I read some time ago that for a long time, Intel was employing futurists to help them understand and really look at how computers would be used 25 to 50 years out, because they needed to start planning how those chips get built today, right? So they needed really a prescient look at what is the future of computing going to look like, and how do they start planning for that? Despite the fact that our financial systems are driven by sort of quarterly and yearly reports and short-term thinking, there are definitely these R&D labs in a lot of corporations and within startups who are thinking really far ahead and really trying to build a future, really trying to project into the future the ways that people are going to be living, consuming, engaging with each other, all these different things. And so it just really made sense to me to say, well, great, if we're already projecting into the future, let's at least make sure we're using the storytelling methods we have now that reach billions of people every day, as advertising does, to at least drive towards the future that we want to be a part of versus some sort of, you know, Mad Max dystopia. So yeah, that, I mean, and then I dove into the research for the book. You know, I really wanted to understand, again, the behavioral science behind it, the neuroscience behind it, which I found absolutely fascinating. I think for humans, just the way we're wired, it's very difficult for us to understand ourselves in any future capacity. So, and it's funny because the insurance, you know, life insurance and insurance companies and, you know, retirement plans, they deal with this all the time, trying to get people to understand what life is going to be like 20, 30, 40 years in the future. Because when we think about ourselves in the future, the same parts of our brain that light up are the same parts of our brain that light up when we think about a complete stranger now, right? So when you think about yourself in the future, you're literally thinking about a complete stranger, and you have no empathy necessarily for this person. You have no connection to them as you do to yourself, right? So you can't really think about your self-interest in that capacity. If we could, I don't think we'd be in the spot we're in terms of where the planet's at, because we would actually be able to understand what our life is going to be like, you know, 50 years from now when things continue to sort of get worse.
So let's stay here for a minute, because it's a really interesting can of worms that you opened up in terms of commitment to something today that is off in the future. So my first job out of university, I worked for a great mayor, Ed Koch, and I was a policy analyst for something called the Commission on the Year 2000. And it was a blue ribbon panel, very, very smart folks on a broad continuum of subjects, people like Donna Shalala for education and Bob McGuire, who was probably the greatest police commissioner New York City has ever had for crime, and all people of that level of expertise. This was 1986, and it was a vision. What will New York be like in the year 2000, and what do we need to be ready? And just as you referred to the Intel example to understand what the future of computing would look like and guide the way forward in terms of chips and research and technology, there are a lot of things that you can look at hard today and understand what's coming and allow us to be prepared. Where do you see things now? And I want you to put your green thread horizon hat on a little bit. Where do you see the willingness of corporate America, global clients to pay attention to something today that requires investment and change where the ROI may be down the road?
That's a challenge that I think the sustainability and climate community and environmental community for many years has been struggling with, right? Because there's this inherent tension, obviously, between living sustainably, and I use that term broadly, and the consumption of capitalism, right? Which is part of what these organizations are driving. Not to say consumption is incorrect, but to get organizations to understand how to navigate that tension has definitely been a challenge. And so, you know, I think organizations are sitting up and taking notice these days, for sure. They can't not, right? I mean, you just read the news and you see one disaster after another that is climate change related in some way. And so they're looking at it sort of from a risk mitigation standpoint, maintaining their supply chains. And so they're looking at it financially from that lens. Where I think the gap has been, like you said, what that return on investment is in actually actively investing in sustainable development and sustainable communications in that regard, and really how they start to utilize their own position and influence to drive positive change. And the fact is, as cynical as it may sound, altruism within an organization only gets you so far. You know, every major organization has a foundation and they do great work within their communities and with the environment and all these different things. But real change doesn't actually come until you see that financial incentive. And we see this right now with boards that are starting to incentivize the C-suite of major organizations with, you know, financial bonuses that are attached to ESG capabilities or capacities. Now, we can go down a whole rabbit hole of the validity of ESG as rankings, et cetera, because there's lots of debate about that. But ESG is data, right? I mean, at the end of the day, ESG is just data points. And now these data points are being used to financially incentivize certain decision-making within organizations. And so that's when you start to real change. And that's when you start to navigate that tension between sustainability and consumerism. Within my role at Horizon and Green Thread, which is the B2B practice at Horizon Media, we see that every day because part of media's role is to drive continued consumption, right? We're working with our clients to get their customers to buy more stuff or consume more services or whatever it is. So how do we actually do that in a sustainable way? Well, one is you actually look at the advertising industry, right? How do you actually decarbonize the value chain of placing the ads, the sort of programmatic auctions that happen, and how do you create carbon neutral options for clients to paths to go down? That's one. And we're working on that horizon as well. But the other piece that we're digging into pretty heavily right now with it's myself, my colleague, Stephen Diorio, a couple of other in the organization. We're looking at how do you make the connection between the chief sustainability officer, which is a growing role within many organizations, and the chief marketing officer. What are those pieces that the two of them are going to be reacting to in concert with each other? And how do we bring those things together so that growth within an organization, we talk a lot about sustainable growth within an organization. And here, sustainability has two meanings, right? On the one hand, it's scalable, it's predictable, it's what every organization wants to understand. How am I going to grow over the next 10 years at a standard rate, very predictable, so that my shareholders, my investors are all very happy. But the other side of sustainable is, how do I do this in a responsible way? And so connecting the CSO with the CMO so you can actually have an overview of your whole revenue cycle from a sustainability standpoint, and then be able to actively communicate that, not just externally to your consumers, your shareholders, et cetera, but internally to your stakeholders within the business. So your CEO, your whole C-suite, all of your employees, et cetera, they all understand what's happening, why this is so important, and how to actually help drive this. Those connections are hard to make because, again, there has to be that financial driver, but they're there. Those connections are there. And the research, you know, that we're doing right now is drawing out all these pieces that show, yeah, here's all the places where the CSO and the CMO can play very well together, can actually drive a significant difference while also helping the company to grow. And the flip side to that is helping your consumers understand that it's not just about consuming anything, it's about consuming better. right? It's about having options and making the better choices for what's going to be good for your community, what's going to be good for your family, what's going to be good for the planet as a whole. And this is where my work with Horizon and my work with New Zero World, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself here, but my work with New Zero World, it overlaps really, really nicely, because within Horizon, especially in the B2B practice, we're deeply embedded in how organizations are able to build their communication structure, build their media structure, et cetera, et cetera. On the New Zero World side and with the Earth Public Information Collaborative, EPIC, we are looking at driving, okay, how do we actually use then the output of these organizations, the advertising that these organizations put out every single day to billions of eyeballs every day? How do we actually get that machine behind making better choices, behind helping to grow this total addressable market of people who are actively looking for products and services that are greener, more sustainable, part of the circular economy? I mean, a lot of these options are out there. A lot of organizations are actively building new and better options within this space. And now it's a matter of accelerating adoption and consumption in that regard. So it's not about consuming less necessarily, it's about consuming better. And yes, there's, again, lots of debates about how, you know, where that tipping point is, how much can we actually consume. But really, if you're operating in a circular economy where the inputs of the resources are legitimately counted within the process, right, and within the cost, and the outputs, the waste is also counted, because these are pieces of the puzzle within the supply chain that don't get counted in the cost of a product or service, right? They're just sort of like ancillary or external factors. If you're building a truly circular economy, if you're building a truly circular product or service, theoretically, you should be able to consume it all you want, right? There should not actually be a limit to what that consumption looks like, because you're putting back into the system what you took out in some regard. Now, those things are enormously complex and interconnected. And one of the things that we talk about a lot at EPIC and in New Zero World is climate change. Sustainability is so much more than just those terms. The interconnectedness of these systems is mind-boggling to some degree. But it is, when you talk about, we say a lot, it's a quote from Margaret Atwood, we're not talking about climate change, we're talking about the everything change. I mean, because everything in some way is connected back to the planet that we live on, the people that we live with, the communities that we're in. So it's a tough message to get. You know, people are looking for sort of what's the simple answer. How do we change our lives in the most simple and convenient and straightforward way to, you know, mitigate or abate the worst of the climate crisis? But, we're kind of at a point where we need to be taking a hard look and getting people to be really thinking through systems changes versus, you know, individual changes. And for a long time, look, the onus has been put on the consumer, saying, hey, you need to make better choices. You need to make better choices. And this is done very deliberately. I won't, you know, we don't have to deep dive into sort of the nefariousness of some of the ways we got here, but these were very deliberate strategies and methodologies to make consumers feel like they need to be doing more while not looking at the larger system at play and what needs. And again, when we go back to the everything change, it's everything. It's, yes, we have individual choices that we need to make, but we also have systems that we need to enable, that need to enable consumers to be able to make those better choices, right? So that's really heady stuff, right? That's like really sort of philosophical. But when it comes down to it, what we do at EPIC is we try to take all of that heady stuff, which comes from the science, it comes from the journalism, it comes from all the research that's already out there, and we try to sort of distill it through this filter of the superpower of advertising and marketing, because we have this power. We have, you know, the power of creativity, the power of communications, the power of storytelling. We know that it shapes culture, right? All the research says that. We know that it drives behavior, and we know all these things. All we're trying to do at EPIC, you know, we're not trying to really change the way any system operates. We're trying to operate with the systems we have, because we don't, yes, over the long term, we need to change systems. But right now, at the speed and scale that we need to be moving, given the urgency of the crisis, we're just taking the pieces that we have and using them in a way that hasn't been done before.
So let's take a pause for a sec. We're going to dive deeply into the origin story of EPIC and New Zero World. And you touched on a lot of heady stuff, important stuff. But let's focus on the timely and topical for a second. Here in our town in New York, the governor recently reversed a plan to put in congestion pricing. London has it, works very effectively. In London, the city has not collapsed. The economy of the city has not collapsed. It has done what it was supposed to do, which is reduce traffic in central London, reduce emissions. They're much more aggressively moving towards electric cars in the UK than we are here, even as their charging network struggles to keep up with that, but they're doing it. Here, the governor caved and stopped the law. The MTA has now said all the money we were expecting to get from that to fund all of these capital improvements to mass transportation. You know, people forget that our subway system, the bones of it, are 120, 130, 140 years old. They've now said, well, all that, you know, money that we don't have now, all those projects are now not going to go forward. Today, we saw the Supreme Court strike down a Biden rule about EPA admissions and a good neighbor law that basically said that, you know, one state can't pollute another. Talk about what you see, Chris, about the absence of political will and potentially in our country, depending on how things go in November, a radical undoing of policies that are going to shape an awful lot of this.
Yeah, it's depressing. The governor caved.
A Democratic governor caved,
right? And clearly, I don't have all the details. Obviously, I'm not part of that inner circle, but I have to imagine there was, you know, financial pressure on her. And that's sort of what it came down to. And to me, there are parallel paths that we need to be taking. There are a lot of great organizations out there that are doing work directly with leaders, policymakers, et cetera. Off the top of my head, Groundswell is one of them. Their focus is on the people who are in leadership and swaying their decision making, which is great and very, very much needed. However, that can't happen in a vacuum. And so what needs to happen, and the reason why our focus with Epic is at the public, is because if you get that top down and bottom up, you need both layers in order to really see any significant change on a policy level, on a corporate level, on an organization level, because it's the same with government and politics and policy as it is with organizations. When the people start demanding it, it actually happens. Right. So when with a corporation, when the people start moving their money towards something more sustainable, the corporations will follow without a doubt. And the same goes with the politics. So if you can start using those tactics to drive understanding, to drive that behavioral change within a broader public, a voting public, you're going to see more and more of these leaders who are also feeling the pressure from the top as well, right? From these organizations who are coming in and saying, here's why you need to be doing this. Here's why it's good for the state on a whole. Here's why it's good for a country on the whole, et cetera. But when you start also getting the public coming in and saying, hey, you know, I actually do want congestion pricing because I'm sick of air pollution, right? And what has been, I think, really missing in the storytelling of it is the way that these policies that are being made, or these policies that are being broken, the way that these changes in our climate and the decisions that we're making, how that affects us. And it's really selfish to say, because we all want to sit around thinking, yeah, I'm going to think about the best for my community and my planet and my future generations, my grandchildren, whatever. And the fact is that when these subjects are made relevant to us, I am breathing bad air. My asthma is worse because of the air I'm breathing in New York City than somewhere else. And that's because of all the cars and the buses and the pollution and whatever, because our governor has struck down congestion pricing, which would have helped the problem. So making those connections on a broad scale actually gets people to understand how this affects them. And look, politicians have been doing this for decades, centuries, probably thousands of years at this point, to get their way, right? Make it relevant to their voter. But we haven't seen a lot of that in the communications around climate and why this matters from a climate perspective. Because to me, yes, congestion pricing was about, the story we heard was about less traffic. And, you know, I saw a lot of talk about ambulances being able to get to hospitals faster because there's less congestion and more walkable streets and all these different things. And all of those are very valid. But to me, it's a climate issue. To me, it's the air that we're breathing. And again, the interconnectivity of creating a space that is less congested with automobiles also means more green space, right? It means more carbon sinks. It means more the connective tissue across all of these issues, I think, gets lost in the noise. But that relevance, that individual relevance today versus future individual relevance or broader community relevance. And I'm not saying those things aren't important. I think there's a holistic story. There's a holistic approach that needs to be taken here. And again, we talk about this a lot within New Zero World and within Epic. It's a whole earth approach. But what that means is with that connectivity across the whole earth, and that's the biodiversity, it's, you know, the oceans and the forests and the air and the people. And within that, what we really need to do is, how do we take that and tell a story about people or a person? How do we make this very, very relevant to the people who are actually going through this right now? And, you know, you see that. I saw a story in, I think it was the Times today. The folks in East Harlem are pissed at the governor because she shot down this law and the Second Avenue subway isn't getting built now. That's a very relevant story to them about transportation, about being able to get around. And if you took that tactic and made a very relevant story to people in East Harlem or people in downtown or people in Astoria where I am or whatever it is about the climate issue here, you would see more people voting on climate than currently are. That number is growing, but it's growing slowly. I saw the Yale Climate Communications came out today with, I think it said 37% of US voters vote on climate as one of their issues. 37%, that's not terrible, but it's not anywhere near where we need to be to actually move the needle on policy. And then look, there's the other bear is actually, you know, removing the entrenched powers, the lobby groups, and there are lobby groups on both sides, obviously, but removing the power of lobby groups and the power of money within the system. But that's, again, a systems level change. And we need to be doing both of these things at the same time. And so at Epic, we looked at what's going on around us. There are agencies out there that are doing great climate communications work. There are plenty of advertisers out there who can change behavior and know how to do that. There are plenty of organizations who are working with the powers that be. There are plenty of organizations working to sort of divestment from politics or from corporate portfolios and that sort of thing. And really what was lacking was this look at, how do we take the science and make it relevant to the public? Where's the public education in all of this? And it's part of what we found amazing is that within the Paris Agreement, 2015, Articles 6 and 12 more or less say countries should be enabling the public with information, right? We need to be communicating the information that the public needs to make the right decisions around the climate. And that just hasn't happened. There's been very little of that. And what has happened, this is not to disparage any of the work out there, that what has happened, though, is that it's hyper-focused on certain issues, say sort of ocean plastic or, you know, deforestation or that sort of thing. But a lot of those things are so far removed from where the problems are caused. A lot of those things, and there's no overarching narrative that kind of ties all these things together. And when you look at any brand or any corporation, what they do is they build an overarching narrative for their brand, who they are, what their mission is, what they value, why you should care about them as a brand. And then they distill that to all the different stories, all the different products, all the different services that they need to in some regard. So they have this thing that is rigid enough to allow for identity, but flexible enough to allow for broad use. And that's when we look at how people communicate about sustainability, we recognize that this doesn't exist right now, right? We don't have a consistent narrative around the importance of this and the planet itself. And we don't have something that people can connect back to for sort of maximum engagement and maximum understanding.
Okay, so let's pause again. Clearly, Chris, we're going to have to do a 2 or 3-parter with you. So let's give us the Epic origin story. And let's talk sort of, you know, what you and Natalia are doing, where it is now. You launched, give or take, the fall of 23, so it's relatively new. But give us really the origin story, the ambition over the medium term, and let's take the pulse on where we are right now as we start to sniff 1-year anniversary.
I love that because I think it's an important story. So it really started, I came into Epic, I guess, more or less at the ground floor, but the seed of Epic started with a research paper that Natalia and New Zero World were putting together in collaboration with the Global Commons Alliance. And this research paper, it's called A New Era in Climate Communication. I encourage everybody to go read. It is in depth, right? There is a lot of stuff in there. But go to climatecommunications.earth, a very simple URL. So I I had joined Horizon. One of the first things that I did at Horizon was sort of sync up with the sustainability team there because it's a passion of mine. I want to be involved. And one of the first things that happened was we connected with Natalia, New Zero World, Global Commons Alliance on this paper. And so myself, my colleague, Jean-Marc Pepin at Horizon, we contributed to some content to this paper. And in doing so, we started this conversation with Natalia, and the research explores climate communications, the importance of it, the behavioral science behind it, all these different aspects. And sort of the takeaway from this, or the output from this, was this recognition that we needed some machine apparatus in place, some coordinating factor in place for this ecosystem of all the pieces that were currently fragmented. And so that was the kernel of EPIC. At Horizon, every year we put on the Sustainable Media Summit, and we invited Natalia to come speak about the paper, which she did. And it was amazing. And she got a great reception at the event. And look, I just happened to be standing in line behind her for the buffet after she had presented. And I said, hey, I wrote a book that basically talks about exactly what you just talked about, right? The sheer power and influence of marketing and communications to be able to influence our behavior towards sustainable development. My book talked a lot about technology adoption and accelerating that with an eye towards sustainable development. So we touched base, we hit it off right away, and we have so much in common in terms of the way that we were trying to bring these stories to market, so to speak, that it was a very easy and natural collaboration for us to start building EPIC together. And so, yeah, I joined them almost a year ago. And since then, we've had EPIC, you know, we've been talking about EPIC. We were at COP last November. We just got back from Cannes last week. And the recognition and understanding from the industry has been incredibly encouraging. I think everybody really understands what we're trying to do and why, and how we are proposing we do it. And now the next step really is, okay, what are we going to do, right? And that's exactly where we are right now. We're looking at Climate Week coming up to be able to share sort of what our pilot program, I hesitate to call it a campaign, because when you say campaign within advertising or marketing circles, they think, all right, digital advertising, maybe some out of home, you know, whatever, TV ads, whatever. But the way we use campaign within the scope of what we're doing is far broader than that, right? It could be anything from, so for example, Natalia had a session with Netflix scriptwriters where she sat down with them and said, look, here's how you actually inject sustainability, climate communications, whole earth approach into your script writing. And if you can do that where people are consuming content, that's a huge cultural driver, right? So when we talk about campaign, we're not just talking about advertising, we're talking about all the different ways that people find and consume content and all the different ways that we can actually help to drive their decision-making through the ways that they, in these places where they're already going, right? We want to meet them where they're at versus trying to sort of get them to go read a white paper or look at a graph or whatever. No, just we need to start meeting people where they're at to really have an effect on a cultural shift towards sustainability acceptance.
Well, I love that. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of coming up with really almost a new language and a new methodology to try to move the needle on this problem, because clearly what we've been trying has not been working. And I love what you and Natalia are doing. I'm thrilled that we got a chance to connect at Climatech. I know you saw our folks and are continuing to talk about how we can weave EPIC New Zero World into Advertising Week in October. We are 20th year in New York, hard to believe. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this, Chris. We will definitely do a part two. I want to get Natalia on as well and continue to build this partnership with you. I think it's vitally important work. I'm a big fan of your the big boss at Horizon, Bill Koningsberg. He's been a dear friend for a long time. I rate him really, really highly. I think he runs the best shop in the business by far, and just a quality guy. So thanks for doing this. This was really, really, really something.
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate you having me. Would love to do this again and get Natalia into the conversation. So yeah, thanks. Really appreciate you and everything you're doing.